another day, another dollar makes you wonder where your money went. You can scream and you can holler, it really doesn't matter.
Hi, this is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. One man's view of the changing world and changing economic times, and the things we can do to live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. You got me on a rainy, gray Tuesday morning, 74 degrees, as I make my commute from Arlington to Frisco, Texas, knocking down 50 miles once again in my little Volkswagen, my mobile studio coming to you from North Texas. And it is a Tuesday podcast because Monday I was off. As I mentioned last week, we took a four-day vacation to our retreat up in Arkansas. And we didn't do a lot of work up there. My wife and I took some time reconnecting and just spending time together. It's another important part of your survival planning there, guys. Occasionally do some marriage survival planning, which often involves just unplugging yourself from work, hobbies, and various other things that distract you from spending time with the people that you love and care about the most. So there's my little public service announcement of the day. One of the things that I actually did do, though, while we were up there is I spent an awful lot of time reading. And reading, I actually read a book and a half, and the first book that I read was Patriots Surviving the Coming Collapse by James Wesley Rawls, a book that I had mentioned in an earlier podcast. Found it online, saw a lot of people talking about it in the forums, decided I'd check it out, read the first chapter, thought it's a little bit sensationalist, but it seems like it might be interesting, so I went ahead and ordered the book. And fortunately for me, it showed up before we departed, about a day before. And so I had it with me, and I had all that free time, those 4 days to sit back and read. And I got to tell you, I read the book cover to cover. And I have some very, very favorable things to say about Mr. Rawls' book, again, which is Patriots Surviving the Coming Collapse. I also have some negative things to say about it. And I want to temper those negative things with saying that, you know, first and foremost, I think James Rawls is an incredible individual. I think he's got an incredible insight into the potential threats that we face and how to deal with them. He has a blog called thesurvivalblog.com. Most of my listeners have probably read it or at least heard of it. If you haven't, stop by. It's a great resource. And, you know, I want you to understand that even though I'm going to have some negative things to say, that I like Mr. Rawls. And important, or more important, I guess, than anything, is to understand that despite my negative thoughts on some of the parts of this book, I did read it cover to cover, and I could not put it down, which that says something about the effectiveness of it. And I think that the reason that I'm going to have some of these few negative things to say about it is what Mr. Rawls tried to accomplish with this book. It was something that just has never been done before. And that is, he tried to take a survival manual type of situation where you're giving away information on how to store food, how to harden structures, how to deal with basic combat tactics, use communications techniques, all these different things, have standard operating procedures to be well planned out, food storage, vehicle preparation, all these different things. And he tried to do it in the form of a narrative, a story, a novel, so that you would have a vested interest in paying attention to the information. That was a challenge. He did a pretty good job of it. There's some parts, again, I'm going to get into here in a second, that I find a little bit like, I don't know. But I don't have a solution. So all in all, I have to give the book overall an A on accomplishing its mission and being an interesting read. On the quality of, like, the authorship, if I was judging the writing in itself, it's like a C minus to a D. And it's mainly that because to get the technical and specific information into the story, what James Rawls did was have the characters explain in laborious detail how they did what they did, why they did what they did. Just to put it bluntly, nobody talks the way that some of the characters during some situations talk in this book. It's just, nobody speaks that way. And, you know, I was in the Army Airborne, all right? And I'm telling you, even if I get together with some old Army buddies and a few of my high school buddies that were in the Marine Corps, and we sit down and talk and throw some beers back, no matter how tactical we get in our communications, we don't talk this way. So that's just a reality. But then again, how would you get those details into the book unless you wrote them into it? So that was a challenge, and overall, I have to say that it was accomplished fairly well. You know, and then I guess the other criticism I had is that at times he brings people in that are of different backgrounds, like one of the people that eventually ends up at this retreat is married to a lady from Honduras, and just kind of over-exaggerates the accent into the writing, I guess to just indicate that this person is indeed of Hispanic descent and from Honduras, and nothing negative about that at all. I mean, this book is, I've heard some of the reviews calling it racist and right-wing extremist and whatnot. I guess to a lot of people it would be right-wing extremist because, you know, it's pro-freedom, so you can't do anything with that, but the racism thing is just stupid. It's just dumb, and there's nothing racist about it, and I don't see the way that her dialect is depicted as being racist. I just see it as a poor execution in authorship. I'm sorry, I feel that way if Mr. Rawls ever actually listens to this, but it just, it's overdone. Again, that's it. The book itself, I have to give an A on accomplishing its mission. You pick it up, you read it, and it makes you think. And the scenario, I think, is way overblown with what's likely to happen. And I think, again, maybe making a little bit of allowance here for the author, he wanted to convey, you know, worst-case scenario. Because if you could deal with the worst-case scenario, then dealing with anything less is easier to do. So he went to the extreme with the economic meltdown, societal collapse, and then eventually government's response to it. So, you know, that's kind of my critique. And the reason I wanted to do that first, talk about my negative feelings about this first, is I'm going to now give you some very positive sides to this book and some of the things it made me think about and some of the takeaways I have. And you're going to come through this and you may want to go out and read it. If I hadn't talked about that first, especially if you're not like a gun nut type of person, and I don't mean gun nut the way that the liberals talk about us, but a gun nut in the way we talk about ourselves, like, I really like guns, and I like to talk about guns and stuff like that, you know, and you read this book without that caveat, you're going to be like, man, Jack's, you know, sent me down the wrong river. I think understanding that, you'll be able to listen to my review and decide whether this book's for you or not, and it's something you want to add to your library. Okay, let me start out with some of the things that the book made me think of that I either do or don't do now, and maybe or don't always discipline myself at times when things are pretty good and I don't feel that we need to follow them. The first and foremost thing, the entire book from cover to cover, what you realize is that these people that are characterized in this book have what we referred into the military as a SOP, or standard operating procedure. For everything that's done, this is a standard by what is done, how it's done, who's responsible for it, and there's checks in place to make sure that you don't not do them, okay? And, yeah, in a situation where you have to run patrols around your own home, and you have to have somebody sit up on a hill watching to make sure that no one's coming to invade, I guess those things are valuable. In fact, of course those things are valuable, and everybody sees the value there. But in day-to-day life, in day-to-day living, having SOP is extremely valuable as well. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to run around in combat boots and fatigues to have SOP. And I'll tell you a real story about me and my wife that just happened this weekend while we were away, where failure to follow SOP caused a little bit of concern. Nothing really happened, but it made for a little bit more stressful of a situation. I was asked by my beautiful wife to go pick up a Monster Energy drink for her down at the convenience store, which is about a 15-minute drive down our hill and then down into town, which means my entire time I should be gone should be about 30 minutes, give or take five minus minutes to do this, especially on a early Sunday morning when there's nobody really doing anything and there's no traffic and even at the little bottleneck at the beginning of town. So, like a good husband, I jumped in the car and I drove down the mountain and into town and went inside and purchased the energy drinks and a copy of the local paper just to see what was going on locally. Came outside and decided, you know what, I haven't checked my tire pressure since I got to town, and I put, you know, 300 miles on the car, and I probably should check them, and found that not only was one of the tires low on air, it had a fairly large split in the sidewall. That split was not leaking air, but it looked like something I didn't want to drive back up the rocky dirt road, high pitch of elevation, and maybe have that tire blow out either when I'm driving a little bit too fast, or more importantly, if I ended up on the rim in one of these very steep locations, that would be a place I really wouldn't want to try to change a tire. So what made the most sense was to drive. I didn't really like that area of Hot Springs. That north end of town's a little bit, just a little bit shady. Not maybe where I feel the safest. So I drove about a mile north of town to a little place, like a little park with a nice big parking lot and shade, and pulled under a tree and changed a tire and got everything done, and then drove on back up to the retreat. No problem, no worries. Well, the problem was it took me over an hour, which took me 30 minutes. We drove one vehicle, so my wife was stuck up there. And because I didn't follow what really is our standard operating procedure, although not spoken or stated, I did not make sure that I had my cell phone when I left the house. So I couldn't call her and say, hey, honey, I'm down here changing a tire. So I had to make a decision. Do I take the risk of driving with the tire that way, which was a bad risk, or do I let my wife worry? And I chose to let my wife worry, which was smarter, because I'd rather her worry than end up with the car stuck or me hurt or dead with no way to get in touch with her. So I made the right choice in that I took the time to make the repair, but I made the wrong choice in not following a standard operating procedure, which is you leave the home, you have a means of communication with the other party. That is now written in stone for us. And it's something that really was driven home by this book, because everything that the characters do is driven by a standard operating procedure, something that must be done at all times. So that's something that I really took away from the book, and gets driven home in a number of ways. Another thing that I think is extremely important to think about when we get into these scenarios and probabilities and possibilities of, a societal meltdown, an economic failure, an economic collapse, it's just the overall preparedness that we all, seem to think that we need to make. And what's driven home in this book is things like storing food, storing ammunition, having a means to defend yourself, storing medical supplies are all really important to do. But in the story, as society starts to slowly put itself back together after a big meltdown that's bigger than I expect to actually happen, society almost immediately, when people start communicating with each other and meeting together and assembling in groups again, goes to a barter society. And there's just a lot of things in this book that, as I read them, I went, gee, if you listen to my first 30 podcasts I've done, you'd think I read the book and pulled those right out of there. So I think, I'm seeing a very common main vein, I guess, running through the story in my survival philosophy. And one of those is on, if you're going to be in a barter situation, you don't want to be in a barter situation with gold. Gold's too valuable, even in small quantities, to be able to trade for relatively small everyday goods. And that gets driven home as they start having their first barter fair for this little town in Idaho, where people come from the various surrounding communities to exchange goods with each other after about 2 years into this disaster. And the main things that people are bartering with are gasoline, diesel fuel, guns, ammunition, livestock. Those are the main things that are being used as a true barter, not a type of currency. But the main currency that is accepted is silver coins, primarily pre-1964 silver dimes, nickels, quarters, half dollars, and silver dollars. And if you think about it, a silver dime is actually a fairly sizable chunk of change in the value of the silver that's on it. It's worth a couple bucks. All right, whereas real money, as they call it, the standard U.S. currency may be extremely devalued. Even if it's not completely worthless, it may take an awful lot of $1 bills to add up to enough to buy, let's say, a couple chickens, right, if it gets that basic. but silver coinage will work, and unlike gold, silver is easier to parcel out into small values and makes a better exchange medium than gold. So that was a highly recommended thing. Even though it didn't say, we recommend that you do this, he just pointed out the people that had silver coinage on hand were able to use it to buy things that they didn't have something to barter for, because people would accept that. And that, I think, is a really good idea for anybody to do, because, as you know, I'm big on no-risk survival tactics. I'm not big on, you know, getting rid of the kids' college fund and using it to stock up on mil-serve gear and 10 years' worth of food and underground shelters and stuff like that. I'm like, what can we do with our everyday funds that has no risk to it? And owning silver has very little risk. Silver goes up and down somewhat in price, but it's always worth something. It's always been worth something. It always will be worth something. The worse times get, the more it will be worth, and that's just reality. And if times get bad, that's what you want, is something that increases in value when times get bad. On the other hand, if nothing goes wrong, you still have something of value. Silver is a good investment. The coins themselves may have some numismatic value. I don't believe in going heavily in a numismatic value, because the fact that you have something with an O mint mark on it may be meaningless in a barter economy. But I think silver coinage is a great thing to have. It's something that's really driven home by this book, and it's something I suggest. You know, even if you go by a local coin shop once a week or once a month or something like that, and pick up a handful of silver coins, toss them in a safe place somewhere at home, just so that you have them. I think if we did that, you know, you do that every year, you end up with a pretty good little cache of silver. On the term cash, I mean, that's another thing that's really brought up in this book, and it's brought up by, and this is one thing I like about the book, is he doesn't make out these people in this book to be superheroes, right? Like, they don't do everything right. There's a term that's heard over and over throughout the book, and that is, hindsight is 20/20. A lot of times they'll look at a situation and go, if only we had bought something like that back when they were easy to come by. If only we had put more of this in reserve, right? And then the other characters always say, yeah, hindsight, you know, and that's true. So he allows these characters to make these mistakes and deal with the consequences of them. When did they ever actually have to deal with too much of the consequences, because they end up with enough warning time to get out of Dodge? And what eventually happens is, and if you haven't read the book, I hate to give away things, but I can't do this without kind of giving away some of this. And it really won't matter if you read it, because you kind of know what to expect from a book like this. But they end up in a situation where people are coming, troops are coming from this newly organized government, which is very oppressive. And they have to end up bugging out of their bug-out location. This family that's made it through about 3 years at this point, come through very well. In this new economy, they're actually extremely wealthy simply because they eat well every night. They're warm, they're dry, they're protected. They have beans, bullets, and Band-Aids, right? So they're in good shape, and they're going to have to abandon all this. And they end up taking as much as they can with them to a remote location over about a 10-day period of evac. And they're carrying stuff out. What they realize during this time is, you know, we should have split some of our supplies off a long time ago and cached them up in the wilderness somewhere, or at least at other locations, because if something had happened, if we had been overrun and had to bail out, everything we had was in this one location. That's a fundamental of survival that I think many even hardcore survivalists miss. And I want to talk about a couple different ways to employ that cache. And for some people, they call it cachet. We're not French folks, it's a cache. It just simply means someplace that you store stuff. That's a cache. And in your computer, your browser has a cache, right? That's it stores some of the things that you browse are stored on your hard drive, so they don't have to be downloaded again. Sometimes you have to clear it because you're not seeing new information in certain situations. That's all a cache is. And here's a couple thoughts on this. One, it's no secret. I already put a link to this, and maybe I'll do it from this podcast as well. But what happened during Hurricane Katrina is, as authorities began to move in, one of the first actions that they took, other than trying to suppress the bad guys, and they did do that, let's give them credit for what they did try to do the right way, is they started removing guns from people. And not removing guns from the bad guys, they started removing guns from law-abiding citizens that were staying in their homes that had their guns as a means of self-defense. They would go up and knock on doors and go, hey, lady, you got any guns in here? Give me your guns. And this stuff really happened, and it happened in an almost Gestapo-like way. And fortunately, there was enough balance left on the Supreme Court that it was the NRA was able to have a stop put to it. But it did happen, and it certainly could happen again, and if the court structure changes, it could happen unabated. So a simple cache might be having some basic, maybe your lower-end weapons of self-defense readily available and your other weapons hidden. If authorities were to come and ask for them in this type of scenario, natural disaster, Katrina, I mean, you're not trying to be subversive here. This isn't treasonous. This is, I'm staying in my home, and if somebody comes and tries to steal from me, they're going to get shot. Well, they're going to get the threat of being shot, so they go try to steal from somebody else. Now, the government comes along, takes away your means of defense. This is insane. All right, this is insane. Don't think you can't go this far, because it can. And right now in England, if you legally possess a gun, and you're an extreme minority if you do, and somebody breaks into your home and you shoot them, you go to jail. Right? And don't say what happens in England can't happen here, because if you look at England 20 years ago, it's a lot like it is here today. All right, we're going right down that path. But anyway, emergency situation, you're in a survival mode, authorities come and take your guns. Now, if you fight them, you're in for a world of hurt, because it's not going to work. They're going to get your guns. And if you don't follow things the right way, you're going to end up shot or arrested. Now you can't take care of your family. Now you can't protect your home. Doesn't make any sense at all. On the other hand, if they ask you if you have guns and you say no, then they're likely to search for them and find everything they can and take it away from you. So if you have a few firearms that you consider somewhat expendable, and you were to say, sure I do, I have this and this and this, they're all legal, they're mine, you've now complied. If they're in the mode of seizure and they take those, it's probably the end of the story because they figure that, you know, you were up front and you told them what you had. Now you're not defenseless, all right? Now, the same thing with food. If you store all your food in one place, you're an idiot. Say that again, because if it's you, I want that to hit you between the eyes. If you store all of your food, all your supplies in one location, you're an idiot. You're an idiot because in whatever kind of disaster that eventually occurs, that spot could be what's damaged, destroyed, stolen, what have you. Now, you've lost everything, and all your preparations have meant nothing. Even on your own property, even inside the walls of your own home, your food does not go all in one pantry. It gets broken up and dispersed throughout the home. That way, if half the home is destroyed in the tornado, and you can't get to the stuff, it's been damaged beyond salvation, you have another location. Somebody breaks in and steals, you know, ammunition, and all your ammunition is one point. Some bad guy just got away with all your ammunition. It's not responsible. So that gets spread throughout the home and hidden in different locations as well. I mean, it's just common sense. In our, you know, situation, we want to eventually have a fairly good stockpile of things in our retreat location. So we have to leave for whatever reason, be it our eventual permanent move, or an interim move, just where something goes wrong here, we have a place to go that's already somewhat supplied. Even there, you want to have things cached. And it's probably not going too far to eventually start, you know, once you have the basics covered, to start caching some things in some other locations. Even along the lines of caching some stabilized fuel in some different locations may be a good idea, because those things could be valuable commodities if we ever have a complete, total breakdown of society, which, folks, I'm telling you, I really think is possible. The next thing that really comes across in this book is the two biggest threats that we have in this nation is ourselves and the government, because the government is us, and we've allowed these idiots to do what they've done, and the biggest pain that we may have because of what we've allowed them to do is an eventual economic collapse. In this book, it's not the Russians that invade us, at least not at first. They kind of show up along with the Belgians and the Germans and the English and everybody else. It's UN troops after this disastrous meltdown occurs several years into it. But that's not what causes the collapse. That's not what causes the immediate trauma. It's the fact that our government is so deeply in debt to so many other foreign powers. And eventually, all these people that are holding treasury notes, U.S. treasury notes, start calling them in and going, hey, where's our money? Give us some money. We don't feel confident you're going to be able to repay it anymore. The Fed starts just printing money left and right, devalues the dollar becomes worthless, and society breaks down. And eventually it leads to riots in the streets and blood in the streets and the electrical grid down and everything else. And almost no semblance of an organized law enforcement, civil services, federal services, it's all gone. It's all down, and there's no gas, and there's nothing, right? And like I said, I think that the extreme example is a bit too far to the extreme, but the concept that various foreign governments might eventually say, we don't want our money in dollars anymore, pull it out, and that would cause a major economic collapse, that is completely, totally feasible. That is reality. Our country is in a $100 trillion hole. A $100 trillion hole. The $9 trillion of public federal debt is a scratch on the surface of reality. And we're in a $100 trillion hole if we trust that the numbers are all true and accurate and no shady stuff is going on and no errors have been made. And folks, to expect that no errors have been made when we're talking about $100 trillion both intentionally and by just basic human error is ridiculous. I'll tell you what, if we got and we sent auditors into our federal government, into our state governments, and into our financial institutions across the world, we would find that their great bookkeeping probably makes Enron, Tyco, and WorldCom look like the Boy Scouts. All right, it might make Bear Stearns look like the Cub Scouts. That's how bad it really might be. It's sooner or later, this has to result in a trauma of some sort. This has to result in a collapse of some sort. How bad and what it's going to be like is really the issue. I think we're more in store for something along the lines of what Argentina went through when their currency became virtually worthless, or Russia went through after the breakup of the Soviet Union and the ruble just started down, 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 down. All right. In both of those societies, it got pretty bad. It got pretty hard for people, and the people that prepared did well, or better at least, than the people that didn't prepare. Okay, that was reality there. But neither one of those scenarios did we end up with, you know, complete, total societal meltdown, no electricity, everything just gone, right? So I think that's more what we're preparing for. But I do think that understanding that the biggest threat right now is the financial threat. It is clearly illustrated in this book, and it's a very plausible scenario about how it might come down. The other thing that's brought up simply by the actions people take, which is as these things start to go wrong, and as they start to make preparations, they pay off debt, and they pay cash for everything that they can pay cash for. Even though they end up in a society where it probably wouldn't matter, because there was nobody around to even collect the debt. Right, and I think, like again, I'm saying the Mr. Rawls here went to the extreme and tried to put everything in it. So doing things like paying property taxes in advance, paying cash for your home, paying off any debt you have, very, very good for survival-minded people, because at the worst time, the last thing you need is a wolf at your door taking away what you have, and doing it through legal means instead of illegal means. See, and that's the biggest thing that I really got out of this book. I read this book, and like the first 60% of it is all about the collapse, how people immediately responded to it, what this group of individuals did to defend their little retreat, to provide for themselves, to live well, to take care of each other, and to defend themselves from things like the roving hordes that we always hear about, biker gangs, bandits, just thieves, looters, things like that. And through that whole thing, you have a lot of hope. You really do. Or as John Edwards would say, hope, right? You have a lot of hope that things are going to work out, you know? And then the provisional government gets formed, and this guy comes in and starts talking about national ID cards, taking away people's guns, and all these other things that you know the UN would like to do if they ever had the opportunity. And it's the UN supporting this new falsely elected provisional government of the United States. At that point, as a reader, your hope, in spite of John Edwards, starts to wane, starts to go away. You start to feel more depressed for your characters that you've learned to care about now than you have at any other time, even when some of them were killed. Because now you feel like, boy, this is really bad. Because it's the guise of legalism, the guise of legitimacy that comes in and does the most damage in these situations. People, banks consolidating and going into major foreclosure operations because people can't pay and people being thrown out on the streets. Law enforcement coming in and taking away the guns of law-abiding citizens who are exercising constitutional rights. these are the things that really get bad. So making preparations, not just for the disaster itself, but for the organized response that goes too far, and understanding that there's certain things that you can do to avoid any confrontation whatsoever. In other words, if you pay the mortgage completely off on your home, the bank's never going to try to repossess it because they can't, because it's yours. Right? If you pay your taxes on your home, then the tax office can't come in and try to seize your land because you've paid onto Caesar or his Caesars. Right, so that's another big thing that I got out of this book. So I think I'm right about 30 minutes. I kind of want to wrap up today. This is my first podcast that's coming back from a vacation. And it just, again, kind of went over some things about this book. I might talk about this again a little bit more. I might even do another whole show on some other things that I picked up. Just some things, some extrapolations and how I see they fit in modern society. But again, I want to thank everybody that's been tuning in regularly. And I'd like to encourage you to continue to tune in regularly and let me know what I can do. Get involved in the discussion. If you haven't entered our listener appreciation contest yet, just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com. Click on listener appreciation contest and you can enter there to win a free iPod or some other cool prizes. And help me reach our goal of getting to 1,000 listeners. And we're well on our way. We're over 400 now, according to the FeedBurner stats, and we have a growing mail list, and I'm getting great comments from everybody, so I'd like to thank you for that again as well. And please remember that what we're all about here is helping you live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. That's really what it's all about, folks. Hope you've enjoyed today's podcast, and I hope to continue hearing from you by email and on the forum and by any other means possible. And I hope you have a great day.
You can scream and you can holler, it really doesn't matter, 'cause it all gets spent.